I'd gotten myself out of a hallucination before, and I could do it again. Wiping away the sweat beading my forehead, I concentrated on what I'd been doing before the hallucination started. Go back to Jev. The real Jev. Open a door in your mind. Walk through it. I know about the necklace. At Hank's words, my eyes flew open. I looked between the two men standing in front of me, ultimately focusing on Hank. He knew about the necklace. The one Marcy was looking for? Was there any way the two necklaces were one and the same? No, they're not, I reasoned. Nothing in this hallucination is valid. You're creating every detail of this scene with your subconscious. Focus instead on creating an exit. Jev raised his eyebrows in inquiry.
I'd rather not reveal my source, Hank replied dryly. Obviously, all I need now is an actual necklace. You're smart enough to know this is where you come in. Help me find an Archangel's necklace. Any one will do.
Try your source, Jev said simply, but with a trace of derision.
Hank's mouth compressed into a severe line.
Two Nephilim. Your choice, of course, he bargained. You could alternate between them.
Jev waved him off.
I don't have my Archangel's necklace anymore, if that's where you're going. The Archangels confiscated it when I fell.
That's not what my source tells me.
Your source lied, he said blandly.
A second source confirms seeing you wearing it as recently as this past summer. A moment ticked by before Jev wagged his head at the floor. He tipped his head back and laughed, almost disbelievingly.
You didn't. His laughter died abruptly. Tell me you didn't drag your daughter into the middle of this.
She saw a silver chain around your neck this past June. Jev's eyes sized up Hank.
How much does she know?
About me. She's learning. I don't like it, but my back's against the wall. Help me, and I won't use her again.
You're assuming I care about your daughter.
You care about one of them, Hank said with a sardonic twist of his lips. Or used to. A muscle in Jev's jaw twitched, and Hank laughed.
After all this time, you're still stoking the fire. A pity she doesn't know you exist. Speaking of my other daughter, I also heard she was seen wearing your necklace in June. She has it, doesn't she? He stated rather than inquired.
Jev returned Hank's even stare.
She doesn't have it.
It would have been a genius plan, Hank said, not sounding in the least like he believed Jev.
It's not like I can torture its whereabouts out of her. She doesn't know anything.
He laughed, but the sound didn't ring true.
Now that would be ironic. The one piece of information I need is buried deep in a mind I effectively erased. A shame.
With a flourish, Hank yanked the canvas off the cage. He kicked the metal box into the light, the base scraping over the floor. The girl's hair was tangled across her face, her eyes ringed in black and darting wildly around the warehouse, as though trying to memorize every detail of her prison before the canvas blinded her again.
Well, Hank asked the girl, what do you think, my pet? Do you think we can find you an Archangel's necklace in time?
She turned toward Jev, and there was no mistaking the recognition widening her eyes. Her hands squeezed the bars of the cage so tightly her skin turned translucent. She snarled a word that sounded like traitor. She glared between Hank and Jev, then her mouth snapped open with a piercing, howling scream. The force of the scream hurled me backward. My body smashed through the walls of the warehouse. I flew through darkness, tumbling over and over. My stomach roiled, a great wave of nausea crashing over me. And then I was sprawled face down on the shoulder of the road, my hands curling into the gravel. I scrambled into a sitting position. The air was thick with the smell of cornfields. Night insects droned all around. Everything was exactly as it had been. I didn't know how long I'd been out. 10 minutes? Half an hour? My skin was covered in a sheen of sweat, and this time my shivers were from the cold.
Jev?
I called out hoarsely. But he was gone. Chapter 12. Following Jev's instructions, I walked to Whitetail Lodge. From the reception desk, I called a taxi.
Even if I hadn't known my mom was at dinner, I might not have called her. I wasn't in any condition to talk. My head was filled with too much noise. Thoughts whizzed past, but I made no effort to pin them down. I felt myself shutting down, too overwhelmed to sort through everything that had happened tonight. At the farmhouse, I climbed the stairs to my bedroom. I stripped down. I stretched a nightshirt over my head. I curled into a fetal position under my blankets and fell asleep. I was snapped awake by the sound of shoes moving at a brisk clip outside my door. I must have been dreaming of Jev because my first foggy thought was, "It's him," and I clutched the sheet to my chin, bracing myself for his entrance. My mom flung the door open so hard it slapped the wall. "She's here," she called over her shoulder. "She's in bed." She crossed to me, clutching a fist over her heart as though to keep it from leaping out of her chest. "Nora, why didn't you tell me where you'd gone? We've been driving all over town looking for you." She was panting, her eyes wild and frantic. "I told the hostess to tell you I called V for a ride," I stammered. Thinking back, it had been an irresponsible move, but caught up in the moment, seeing how my mom glowed in Hank's company, all I could think of was how my presence was an intrusion. "I called V. She didn't know what I was talking about." Of course she didn't. I'd never made it that far. Gabe had come along before I'd had a chance. "You can't do that again," Mom said. "You can't ever do that again." Even though I knew it wouldn't help, I started crying. I hadn't meant to frighten her or send her chasing randomly after me. It was just that when I saw her with Hank, I'd reacted. And as much as I wanted to believe Gabe was out of my life for good, his implied threat that he wasn't finished with me was fresh in my thoughts. What had I gotten myself into? I considered how different the night would have turned out if I'd kept quiet and left the 7-Eleven when Gabe had given me the chance. No, I'd done the right thing. If I hadn't stepped in, BJ might not have survived. "Oh, Nora." I let my mom gather me against her and pressed my face into her blouse. "This was just a bad scare, that's all," she said. "We'll be more careful next time." The boards in the hall creaked, and I looked over to see Hank leaning on the doorframe.
"You gave us quite a fright, young lady."
His voice was light and calm, but there was something almost wolfish in his eyes that caused a chill to tiptoe up my back. "I don't want him here," I whispered to my mom. Even though I was sure there was no validity to my most recent hallucination, it haunted me. I couldn't stop picturing Hank tugging the canvas off the cage. I couldn't shut out the words he'd said. Logically, I knew I was projecting my own fears and anxieties on him, but either way, I wanted him to leave.
"I'll call you later, Hank," Mom said reassuringly over the top of my head. "After I tuck Nora in. Thank you again for dinner, and I'm sorry about the false alarm." He gestured it off.
"Don't fret, darling. You forget, I have my own hormonal drama queen under my roof. Though at least I can say she's never done anything this rash."
He chuckled as if he genuinely found any word he'd said amusing. I waited until I heard his footsteps retreat down the hall. I wasn't sure how much to tell my mom, especially since Jev said the police couldn't be counted on and I feared that everything I said now would reach Detective Basso's ears. But too much had happened tonight not to tell anyone. "I met someone tonight," I told my mom, "after I left Coopersmith's. I didn't recognize him, but he said we knew each other. I must have met him sometime in the last 5 months, but I can't remember." Her hold on me grew taut.
"Did he tell you his name?"
"Jev?" She'd been holding her breath, but now a little slip of air escaped. I wondered what it meant. Had she expected a different name? "Do you know him?" I asked. Maybe she would be able to shed light on my history with Jev.
"No. Did he say how he knew you?
From school, maybe. Or when you worked at Enzo's?" I'd worked at Enzo's. This was news to me, and I was about to get clarification when her eyes snapped back to mine.
"Wait, what was he wearing?"
She gestured impatiently. "What did his clothes look like?" I felt my forehead crease in confusion.
"Why does it matter?"
She stood, then paced to the door and back to the bed. As if suddenly aware of how anxious she looked, she parked herself in front of my dresser and nonchalantly examined a perfume bottle.
"Maybe he was wearing a uniform with a logo? Or maybe he was dressed entirely in one color, like black?"
She was clearly leading me, but why? "He was wearing a white and navy baseball shirt with jeans." Worry lines formed clear parentheses around her mouth, which was tightly pursed in thought.
"What aren't you telling me?" I asked.
The worry lines spread to her eyes.
"What do you know?" I demanded.
"There was a boy," she began.
I sat up a little taller.
"What boy?"
I couldn't help but wonder if she was talking about Jev, and I found myself hoping she was. I wanted to know more about him. I wanted to know everything about him.
"He came around a few times. He always dressed in black," she said with obvious distaste. "He was older and, please don't take this the wrong way, but I couldn't figure out what he saw in you. He dropped out of school, he had a gambling problem, and he worked as a busboy at the borderline. I mean, for goodness sake, I have nothing against busboys, but it was almost laughable. As if he thought you were going to stay in cold water forever. He couldn't begin to relate to your dreams, let alone keep up with them. I'd be very surprised if he had the determination to go to college."
Did I like him?
Her description didn't sound like Jev, but I wasn't ready to give up just yet.
"Hardly. You had me make excuses every time he called. Eventually he got the picture and left you alone. The whole thing was very short-lived. A couple of weeks at most. I only brought him up because I always thought something about him was off. And I always wondered if he might have known something about your abduction. Not to be dramatic, but it seemed like a dark cloud settled over your life the day you met him."
"What happened to him?" I realized my heart was pounding in double time.
"He left town." She shook her head. "See, it couldn't have been him. I panicked, that's all. I wouldn't worry about him." She added, coming over and patting my knee. "He's probably halfway across the country by now."
"What was his name?" She hesitated only a moment.
"You know, I don't remember. Something with a P. Peter, maybe."
She laughed louder than necessary. "I guess that proves just how insignificant he was." I smiled absently at her joke, all the while hearing Jev's voice rumble through my mind.
"We knew each other. We met 5 months ago, and I was bad news from the moment you laid eyes on me."
If Jev and this mysterious boy from my past were one and the same, someone wasn't giving me the full story. Maybe Jev was trouble. Maybe it was in my best interest to sprint in the opposite direction. But something told me it wasn't because he was the hardened and indifferent person he was trying so hard to convince me he was. Right before the hallucination, I'd heard him say, "You're not supposed to be in this anymore. Even I can't keep you safe." My safety meant something to him. His actions tonight proved it. And actions speak louder than words, I told myself grimly. Which left only two questions. What wasn't I supposed to be involved in anymore? And given the two, Jev and my mom, who was lying? If they thought I was quite content to sit with my hands in my lap, the perfect model of a sweet, uninformed little girl, they weren't as smart as they thought.
Chapter 13. Saturday morning I woke early, tugged on cotton shorts in a tank, and went running. It felt strangely empowering to pound my feet against the pavement and sweat out all my immediate troubles. I was doing my best not to think about last night. So much for testing my courage by wandering around alone at night. As far as I was concerned, from now on, I'd be perfectly happy to stay locked up in my house the moment the moon showed its face. And if I never had to visit that particular 7-Eleven again, so much the better. Strangely enough, it wasn't Gabe who was haunting my thoughts, though. That job belonged to a pair of sinfully black eyes that had lost their edge when they studied me, turning as soft and sultry as silk. Jeff had told me not to go looking for him, but I couldn't stop fantasizing about all the different ways we might bump into each other again. In fact, the last dream I recalled before waking up this morning was of going to Ogunquit Beach with V, only to discover that Jeff was the on-duty lifeguard. I'd pulled out of the dream with my heart thumping, and the strangest ache shredding me up inside. I could interpret the dream well enough myself. Despite the infuriated, tangled way he'd left me feeling, I wanted to see Jev again. The sky was overcast, keeping the air cool, and after my stopwatch beeped to signal 3 miles, I gave it a smug smile and challenged myself to one more, not quite ready to give up my private thoughts about Jev. That, and I was enjoying myself immeasurably. I'd gone to spinning classes and Zumba at the gym with V, but out in the clean air, saturated with the smells of pine and dewy tree bark, I decided that hands down, I preferred sweating outdoors. After a while, I even tugged out my earbuds,
allowing me to concentrate on the peaceful sounds of nature rising out of dawn. At home, I took a long, luxurious bath, then stood in front of my closet, biting the tip of my fingernail as I studied my wardrobe. In the end, I zipped myself into skinny jeans and tugged on knee-high boots and a turquoise silk camisole. V would remember the outfit, since she was the one who'd persuaded me to buy it during last summer's sidewalk sales. Scrutinizing myself in the mirror, I decided I passed as the same old Nora Gray. One step in the right direction, only 1,000 or so more to go. I was a little worried what V and I would talk about, especially given the glaring issue of my kidnapping, but I reassured myself that that was what made V and me so compatible. I could strategically steer our conversation by raising certain subjects, and V could blather on forever about them. I just had to make sure I got her talking about what I wanted. There was only one thing missing, I concluded, as I checked over my reflection. My outfit needed an accessory. Jewelry. No, a scarf. I pulled out my dresser drawer, a sick feeling sweeping through me when I saw the long black feather. I'd forgotten about it. It was probably dirty. I made a mental note to throw it away as soon as I got back from lunch, but there wasn't much conviction behind the thought. I was wary of the feather, but not enough to give it up just yet. First, I wanted to know what kind of animal had shed it, and I wanted an explanation for why I felt like it was my responsibility to keep it safe. It was a ridiculous thought and didn't make sense, but nothing had since I'd woken in the cemetery. Pushing the feather deeper to the back of the drawer, I grabbed the first scarf I saw. Then I jogged downstairs, pocketed a $10 bill from the freshly stocked petty cash drawer, and folded myself behind the wheel of the Volkswagen. I had to bang my fist on the dash 4 times before the engine caught, but I told myself it wasn't necessarily a sign of a lemon. It meant this car was aged, like, well, fine cheese. This car had seen the world. Chances are it had hauled around at least a few interesting people. It was seasoned and experienced, and held all the charm of 1984. Best of all, I hadn't paid a cent for it. After pumping a few dollars worth of gas into the tank, I motored over to Enzo's. Tidying my hair in the storefront window, I let myself inside. I took off my sunglasses, soaking in the impressive setting. Enzo's had undergone a major makeover since I last remembered. A wide set of stairs led down to the front counter and a circular dining pit. 2 catwalks spread out from either side of the hostess station, scattered with industrial aluminum tables that were part vintage, part chic. Big band-style music played through the stereo system, and for a moment I felt like I'd stumbled through time and landed in a speakeasy. V was kneeling on her chair for a height advantage, whipping her arm over her head like a propeller. "Babe! Over here!" She met me halfway down the catwalk to my right and squeezed me into a hug. "I ordered iced mochas and a plate of sprinkled donuts for us. Man, we have so much to talk about. I wasn't going to tell you, but the heck with surprises. I lost 3 pounds. Can you tell?" She twirled in front of me. "You look amazing," I told her, and I meant it. After all this time, we were finally together. She could have gained 10 pounds, and I'd have thought she was absolutely beautiful. "Self magazine said curves are a fall trend, so I'm feeling really confident," she said, plopping down into her chair. We were at a table set for 4, but instead of taking the chair across from V, I slipped into one directly beside her. "So," she said, leaning forward conspiratorially, "tell me about last night. Holy freak show. I can't believe your mom and Hanky Panky." I raised my eyebrows. "Hanky Panky? We are so calling him Hanky Panky. It's so accurate, it hurts. I think we should call him Frat Boy." "That's what I'm talking about," V said, slapping her palm down on the table. "How old do you think he is? 25? Maybe he's really Marcy's older brother. Maybe he has an Oedipus complex, and Marcy's mom is his mom and his wife." I was laughing so hard I accidentally snorted, which only sent us into deeper hysterics. "Okay, stop," I said, flattening my hands to my thighs and trying to muster a serious face. "This is mean. What if Marcy walked in and heard us? What's she going to do? Poison me with her secret stash of X-lax?" Before I could respond, the 2 available chairs at our table scraped back, and Owen Seymour and Joseph Mancusi sat down. I knew both boys from school. Owen had been in V's in my biology class last year. He was tall and wiry and wore studious-looking black glasses and Ralph Lauren polos. In 6th grade, he'd beaten me out as our grade's representative in the citywide spelling bee. Not that I had hard feelings. I hadn't had a class with Joseph or Joey in years, but we'd known each other since elementary school, and his dad was Coldwater's only chiropractor. Joey bleached his hair, wore flip-flops even in the winter, and played drums in the marching band. I knew for a fact that in junior high, V had a crush on him. Owen pushed his glasses up his nose and smiled benignly. I braced myself for a barrage of questions concerning my kidnapping, but he simply said in a slightly nervous voice, "We saw you guys sitting over here and thought we'd, amble over."
Gee, what a coincidence.
V's curt tone startled me. Not typical for V, who was a self-proclaimed flirt, but maybe she was going for deadpan?
And what do you mean, amble over? Who talks like that anymore?
Have any plans for the rest of the weekend? Joey asked, folding his hands on the table, where they rested a few inches from V's. She drew back, stiffening her spine.
Plans that don't include you.
Okay, not deadpan. I peeked sideways at her, trying to catch her eye long enough to non-verbally articulate what's wrong, but she was too busy evil-eyeing Owen.
If you don't mind, she said,
clearly implying that it was time for them to leave. Owen and Joey exchanged brief, perplexed looks.
Remember when we had P.E. together in 7th grade?
Joey asked V.
You were my badminton partner. You totally rocked at badminton. If memory serves, we won the class tournament.
He raised his hand to give her a high five.
Not in the mood to stroll down memory lane.
Joey slowly dropped his hand beneath the table.
Right. You sure you don't want us to buy you guys a lemonade or something?
So you can spike it with GHB?
Pass.
Besides, we've already got drinks. Something you might have noticed if you were actually looking higher than our chests.
She rattled her iced mocha in his face.
V?
I said under my breath. First of all, neither Owen nor Joey had been looking anywhere remotely close to where V insinuated. And second of all, what was the matter with her?
Okay. Sorry to bother, Owen said, rising awkwardly to his feet. We just thought...
You thought wrong, V snapped. Whatever evil schemes you two have in mind... ain't gonna happen.
Evil what?
Owen repeated, pushing up his glasses again and blinking owlishly.
We get it, Joey said. We shouldn't have butted in. Private girl conversation. I have sisters, he said knowingly. Next time we'll, ask first.
There isn't going to be a next time, V said. Consider Nora and me, she jerked her thumb between the two of us, closed to your business.
I cleared my throat, trying but failing to figure out how to salvage this long enough to end on a positive note. Clean out of ideas, I did the only thing I could. With an apologetic smile, I told Owen and Joey,
thanks, guys. Have a nice day.
It sounded like a question.
Yeah, thanks for nothing, V called after them as they backed away, their whole faces screwed up in bewilderment.
When they were out of hearing range, she said,
What is up with guys today? They think they can just stroll over, flash a pretty smile, and we'll melt in their hands?
Uh-uh. No way, not us. We're wiser than that. They can take their romance scam somewhere else, thank you very much. I cleared my throat. Wow.
Don't wow me. I know you saw right through those guys, too.
I scratched my eyebrow. Personally, I think they were just making conversation. But what do I know? I quickly added when she cast a withering glare at me.
When a guy shows up out of nowhere and instantly turns on the charm, it's a front. There's always a deeper motive. This much I know.
I sucked on my straw. I wasn't sure what else to say. I'd never be able to look Owen or Joey in the eye again, but maybe V was having a day. Maybe she was in a mood. When I watched Lifetime original movies, it took me a day or two to get over the idea that the cute boy next door is actually a serial killer. Maybe V was going through a similar fade-back-to-reality phase. I was about to ask her directly when my cell phone chirped.
Let me guess, V said. That would be your mom checking up on you. I was surprised she let you out of the house. It's no secret she doesn't like me. For a while there, I think she even thought I was somehow mixed up in your disappearance.
She made a grunt of contempt.
She likes you, she just doesn't understand you, I said, opening what appeared to be a text message from none other than Marcy Miller. BTW, the necklace is a man's silver chain. Did you find it?
Give it a rest, I muttered out loud.
Well, V said, what lame excuse did that woman give to drag you home?
How did you get my number? I texted Marcy.
Our parents swap more than spit, dummy.
Right back at you, I thought. I shut my phone and gave my attention back to V. Can I ask a stupid question?
My favorite kind.
Did I go to a party at Marcy's over the summer? I braced myself for a round of over-the-top laughter, but V simply chewed off a bite of donut and said,
Yeah, I remember that. You dragged me along, too. You still owe me for that, by the way.
Not the response I'd anticipated. Weirder question, was I, here goes nothing, friends with Marcy? Now came the reaction I'd been expecting. V nearly coughed her donut onto the table.
You and the hoe, friends. Did I hear that right? I know you've got the whole temporary memory loss thing going on, but how could you forget 11 years worth of Little Miss Payne in the you-know-what?
Now we were getting somewhere. What am I missing? If we weren't friends, why did she invite me to her party?
She invited everybody. She was fundraising for new cheerleading costumes. She wanted $20 from us at the door, V explained. We almost left right then, but you just had to spy on...
She snapped her mouth shut.
Spy on who? I prodded. Marcy. We went to spy on Marcy. That's how it was.
She was nodding a little too vigorously.
And? We wanted to nab her diary, V said. We were going to print all the juicy parts in the e-zine. Pretty epic, right?
I observed her, knowing something was wrong with this picture, but failing to figure out what. You realize how made up that sounds, right? We'd never get permission to publish her diary.
Never hurts to try.
I pointed a finger at her. I know you're keeping something from me.
Who, me?
Spill it, V. You promised not to hold out on me again, I reminded her. V flapped her arms.
All right, all right. We went to spy on...
Dramatic pause. Anthony Amowitz. Anthony Amowitz and I had shared the same PE class last year. Average height, average looks. The personality of a pig. Not to mention V had already sworn there was nothing between them.
You lie. I had a crush on him.
She blushed furiously. You had a crush on Anthony Amowitz, I repeated doubtfully.
A lapse in judgment. Can we not talk about it, please?
After 11 years, V could still surprise. First, swear that you aren't holding anything back, because this whole story sounds shaky.
Girl Scouts honor, V said, eyes clear, expression determined. We went to spy on Anthony. End of story. Just please keep the verbal abuse to a minimum. I'm humiliated enough as it is.
V wouldn't lie to me again, not after we'd just been over this. So despite a few rocky details that I chalked up to embarrassment, I was content with the knowledge I'd been given. Okay, I relented. Back to Marcy, then. She cornered me at Coopersmith's last night and told me her boyfriend, Patch, gave me a necklace that I was supposed to pass on to her. V choked on her drink.
She said Patch was her boyfriend?
I believe the exact term she used was summer fling. She said Patch was friends with both of us.
Huh.
I tapped my finger impatiently on the table. Why do I feel like I'm in the dark all over again?
I don't know any Patches, V said. Anyhow, isn't that a dog's name? Maybe she made him up. If Marcy is good at one thing, it's messing with people's minds. Best to forget all about Patch and Marcy.
Boy, oh boy, aren't these donuts to die for? She thrust one at my face. I took the donut, set it aside. Does the name Jev ring a bell?
Jev? Just Jev? Is that short for something?
By the sound of it, V had never heard his name before. I ran into a guy, I explained. I think we knew each other, maybe from over the summer. His name is Jev.
Can't help you, babe.
Maybe it is short for something. Jevin, Javon, Jevro.
No, no, and nope.
I opened my cell.
What are you doing now?
V asked, sending Marcy a text.
What are you going to ask her?
She scooted up taller.
Listen, Nora...
I shook my head, guessing V's thoughts. This isn't the start of a long-term thing, trust me. I believe you, not Marcy. This will be the last text I ever send to her. I'm going to tell her, nice try, on her big fat lies. Bee's expression lost its tension. She nodded sagely.
You tell her, babe. Tell that cheat her lies are futile with me watching your back.
I keyed in my text and hit send. Looked everywhere, no necklace, bummer. Less than a minute later, her response bounced back. Look harder.
Cheery as ever, I muttered.
Here's what I think, said V. Your mom and Hanky Panky might not be such a bad thing. If it gives you a leg up on Marcy, I'd say promote the relationship full force.
I gave her a sly look.
Of course you would.
Hey now, none of that. You know I don't have one evil bone in my body.
Only 206 of them?
V grinned. Have I mentioned how good it is to have you back?
Chapter 14. After lunch, I drove home. Less than a minute after I'd parked the Volkswagen on the cement slab beside the driveway, my mom bounced her Taurus into the drive. She'd been home when I left earlier, and I wondered if she'd slipped out for lunch with Hank. I hadn't stopped smiling since leaving Enzo's, but my mood cooled suddenly. Mom pulled into the garage and came out to meet me.
How was lunch with V?
Same old, same old. What about you, hot lunch date? I inquired innocently.
More like work, she released a long-suffering sigh. Hugo asked me to travel to Boston this week.
My mom works for Hugo Rinaldi, owner of an auction company of the same name. Hugo conducts high-end estate auctions, and it's my mom's job to make sure the auctions run smoothly, something she can't do long distance. She's constantly on the road, leaving me home alone, and we both know it's not an ideal situation. She'd considered quitting in the past, but it always came down to money. Hugo paid her more, quite a bit more, than she'd make anywhere inside Coldwater's city limits. If she quit, several sacrifices would have to be made, starting with selling the farmhouse. Since every memory I had of my dad was wrapped up in the house, you could say I was sentimental about it.
I turned him down, Mom said. I told him I'm going to need to find a job that doesn't require me to leave home.
You told him what? My surprise wore off quickly, and I felt alarm creep into my tone. You're quitting? Have you found a new job? Does this mean we're going to have to move? I couldn't believe she'd made this decision without me. In the past, we had always taken the same stance. Moving was out of the question.
Hugo said he'd see what he can do about giving me a local position, but not to get my hopes up. His secretary has been working with him for years and does her job well. He's not going to let her go just to keep me happy.
I stared at the farmhouse, stunned. The thought of another family living inside its walls made my stomach roll. What if they remodeled? What if they gutted my dad's study and tore out the cherry floors we'd installed together? And what about his bookshelves? They weren't perfectly straight, but they'd been our first genuine attempt at woodworking. They had character.
I'm not worried about selling yet, Mom said. Something will come up. Who knows, maybe Hugo will realize he needs two secretaries. If it's meant to be, it'll happen.
I turned on her. Are you so casual about quitting because you're counting on marrying Hank and having him bail us out? The cynical observation sprang out before I could stop it, and I immediately felt a wrench of guilt. This kind of rudeness was beneath me, but I'd spoken from that hollow place of fear that hid deep in my chest and overruled all. Mom's entire posture went stiff. Then she clicked off through the garage, punching the button that automatically lowered the door behind her. I stood in the driveway a moment, torn between wanting to go straight inside and apologize and growing fear over her easy avoidance of my question. So that was that. She was dating Hank with every intention of marrying him. She was doing the very thing Marcy had accused her of, thinking of the money. I knew our finances were tight, but we'd survived, hadn't we? I resented my mom for stooping so low, and I resented Hank for giving her a choice other than making do with me. Dropping back into the Volkswagen, I drove across town. I was going 15 over, but for once, I didn't care. I didn't have a destination in mind. I simply wanted to put distance between me and my mom. First Hank, and now her job. Why did I feel like she kept making decisions without consulting me? When the entrance to the highway appeared in the lane ahead, I hung right and followed it to the coast. I took the last exit before Delphic Amusement Park and followed signs to the public beaches. This stretch of coast saw far less traffic than the southern beaches of Maine. The coastline was rocky, and evergreens sprang up just out of reach of high tide. Instead of tourists with beach towels and picnic baskets, I saw a lone hiker and a dog chasing seagulls. Which was exactly what I wanted. I needed time alone to cool down. I jerked the Volkswagen curbside, In the rearview mirror, a red muscle car glided in behind me. I vaguely remembered seeing it on the highway, always hanging a few cars back. The driver probably wanted to squeeze in one last trip to the beach before the weather changed for the worse. I jumped the guardrail and climbed down the rocky embankment. The air was cooler than it had been in cold water, and a steady wind pummeled my back. The sky was more gray than blue, and hazy. I stayed above the reach of the waves, scaling the higher rocks. The terrain grew increasingly difficult to navigate, and I kept my concentration glued on careful foot placement rather than my latest fight with my mom. My boot slipped on a rock, and I went down, landing awkwardly on my side. Muttering under my breath, I regained my footing, and that was when a large shadow fell over me. Taken by surprise, I flipped around. I recognized the driver from the red muscle car. He was taller than average and had a year or two on me. His hair was cut utilitarian short with sandy brown eyebrows and a touch of hair at his chin. By the fit of his sweatshirt, he hit the gym regularly. "About time you left your house," he said, glancing around. "I've been trying to get you alone for days." I pushed to my feet, balancing on a rock. I searched his face for familiarity, but the lights didn't come on. "I'm sorry, do we know each other?" "Do you think you were followed?" His eyes continued to rove the coastline. "I tried to keep tabs on all the cars, but I might have missed one. It would have helped if you'd circled the block before parking."
I honestly have no idea who you are."
"That's a strange thing to say to the guy who bought the car you drove here in." A moment ticked by before I wrapped my head around his words. "Wait, you're Scott Parnell?" Even though it had been years, the similarities were there. The same dimple in his cheek, the same hazel eyes. More recent additions included the scar across his cheekbone, the 5 o'clock shadow, and the juxtaposition of a full, sensuous mouth with sculpted, symmetrical features. "I heard about your amnesia. Rumors are true, then. Looks like it's as bad as they say." My, my, wasn't he optimistic? I crossed my arms over my chest and said coolly, "While we're on the subject, maybe now's a good time to tell me why you ditched the Volkswagen at my house the night I disappeared. If you know about my amnesia, surely you've heard I was kidnapped." "The car was an apology for being a jerk." His eyes still flicked over the trees. Who was he so worried had followed us? "Let's talk about that night," I stated. Out here, all alone, didn't seem like the best place to have this conversation, but my determination to get answers won out. "It seems we were both shot by Rickson earlier that night. That's what I told the police. You, me, and Rickson alone in the funhouse. If Rickson even exists. I don't know how you pulled it off, but I'm starting to think you invented him. I'm starting to think you shot me and needed someone else to blame. Did you force me to give Rickson's name to the police? And next question, did you shoot me, Scott?" "Rickson's in hell now, Nora." I flinched. He'd said it without any hesitation and with just the right amount of melancholy. If he was lying, he deserved an award.
"Rickson's dead?"
"He's burning in hell, but yeah, same basic idea. Dead works, as far as I'm concerned." I scrutinized his face, watching for the slightest false movement. I wasn't going to argue specifics of the afterlife with him, but I needed confirmation that Rickson was gone for good. "How do you know? Have you told the police? Who killed him?" "I don't know who we get to thank, but I know he's gone. Word travels fast, trust me." "You're going to have to do better than that. You might have the rest of the world fooled, but I'm not bought that easily. You dumped a car in my driveway the night I was kidnapped, then you ran off into hiding. New Hampshire, was it? Forgive me if the last word that comes to mind when I see you is innocent. I think it goes without saying, I don't trust you." He sighed. "Before Rickson shot us, you convinced me that I really am Nephilim. You're the one who told me I can't die. You're part of the reason I ran away. You were right. I was never going to end up like the Black Hand. No way was I going to help him recruit more Nephilim to his army."
The wind pierced my clothes, breathing like frost against my skin. Nephilim. That word again. Following me everywhere. "I told you that you're Nephilim?" I asked nervously.
I closed my eyes briefly, praying he would correct himself. Praying that he'd been using the words, "can't die," figuratively. Praying this was where he explained that he was the final stop in an elaborate hoax that had started last night with Gabe. A big hoax, and the joke was on me. But the truth was there, stirring in that murky place where my memory had once been intact. I couldn't rationalize it in my head, but I could feel it, inside me, burning in my chest. Scott wasn't making this up.
"What I want to know is why you can't remember any of this," he said.
I thought amnesia wasn't permanent. What gives?
I don't know why I can't remember, I snapped. Okay? I don't know. I woke up a few nights ago in the cemetery with nothing. I couldn't even remember how I'd gotten there.
I wasn't sure why I felt the sudden urge to spill everything to Scott, but there it was. My nose began to run and I could feel tears forming behind my eyes. The police found me and took me to the hospital. They said I'd been missing for nearly 3 months. They said I have amnesia because my mind is blocking the trauma to protect myself. But you want to know what's crazy? I'm starting to think I'm not blocking anything. I got a note. Someone broke into my house and left it on my pillow. It said even though I'm home, I'm not safe. Someone is behind this. They know what I don't. They know what happened to me. Right then, I realized I'd divulged too much. I had no evidence the note existed. Worse, logic proved it didn't. But if the note was a figment of my imagination, why did the thought of it refuse to fade? Why couldn't I accept that I'd invented, contrived, or hallucinated it? Scott studied me with a deepening frown. They? I threw my hands up. Forget it. Did the note say anything else? I said, drop it. Do you have a Kleenex? I could feel the skin under my eyes growing puffy, and I was past the point where sniffling was helping to keep my nose dry. As if that weren't bad enough, two tears tumbled down my cheek. Hey, Scott said gently, grasping me by the shoulders. It's going to be okay. Don't cry, all right? I'm on your side. I'll help you figure out this mess. When I didn't resist, he pulled me against his chest and patted my back. Awkwardly at first, and then he settled into a soothing rhythm. The night you went missing, I went into hiding. It's not safe for me here, but when I saw on the news you were back and couldn't remember anything, I had to come out of hiding. I had to find you. I owe you that much. I knew I should pull away. Just because I wanted to believe Scott didn't mean I should trust him completely, or let down my guard. But I was tired of throwing up walls, and I let my defenses slip. I couldn't remember the last time it had felt so good just to be held. In his embrace, I could almost make myself believe I wasn't in this alone. Scott had promised we'd get through this together, and I wanted to believe him on that count as well. Plus, he knew me. He was a link to my past, and that meant more to me than I could put into words. After so many discouraging attempts at remembering any fragment my memory saw fit to throw at me, he'd appeared without any effort on my part. It was more than I could have asked for. Wiping my eyes on the back of my arm, I said, "Why isn't it safe for you here?" "The Black Hand is here." As if remembering that the name meant nothing to me, he said, "Just to make sure we're clear, you remember nothing of this. I mean, nothing as in nothing?"
"Nothing." With that one word, I felt as though I were standing at the opening of a forbidding labyrinth that stretched to the horizon.
"Sucks to be you," he said, and despite his word choice, I believed he sincerely meant he was sorry. "The Black Hand is the nickname of a powerful Nephil. He's building an underground army, and I used to be one of his soldiers, for lack of a better word. Now I'm a deserter, and if he catches me, it won't be pretty."
"Back up. What is a Nephil?"
Scott's mouth quirked up on one side. "Get ready to feel your mind blow, Gray." "A Nephil," he explained patiently, "is an immortal." His smile tipped even higher at my dubious expression. "I can't die. None of us can."
"What's the catch?" I asked.
He couldn't really mean immortal as in immortal.
He gestured to the ocean, shattering itself against the rocks far below.
"If I jump, I'll live."
Okay, so maybe he'd been stupid enough to make the jump before, and survived. That didn't prove anything. He wasn't immortal. He simply believed he was because he was a typical teenage guy who'd done a few reckless things, lived to talk about them, and now he believed he was invincible. Scott arched his eyebrows in mock offense.
"You don't believe me? Last night I spent a good 2 hours in the ocean diving for fish, and I didn't freeze to death. I can hold my breath down there for 8-9 minutes. Sometimes I pass out, but when I come around, I've always floated to the surface, and all my vital signs are up and working."
I opened my mouth, but it took a minute for words to form. "That doesn't make sense."
"It makes sense if I'm immortal."
Before I could stop him, Scott whipped out a Swiss Army knife and drove it into his thigh. I gave a strangled scream and leaped for him, unsure if I should pull out the knife or stabilize it. Before I'd made up my mind, he yanked it out himself. He swore in pain, his jeans seeping blood.
"Scott!" I shrieked.
"Come back tomorrow," he said in a more subdued voice.
It will be like it never happened.
Oh, yeah? I snapped, still worked up. Was he completely out of his mind? Why would he do such a stupid thing?
It's not the first time I've done it. I've tried to burn myself alive. My skin was torched, gone. A couple days later, I was as good as new.
Even now, I could see the blood on his jeans drying. The wound had stopped bleeding. He was healing. In seconds rather than weeks. I didn't want to trust my eyes, but seeing was believing. All of a sudden, I remembered Gabe, more clearly than I wanted to. I summoned up a visual of a tire iron projecting from his back. Jev had sworn the injury wouldn't kill Gabe. Just like Scott swore his wound would heal without so much as a scratch.
Okay, then, I whispered, even though I was anything but okay.
You sure you're convinced? I could always throw myself in front of a car if you need more proof.
I think I believe you, I said, failing to keep the dazed bewilderment out of my tone. I forced myself to snap out of my stupor. For now, I was going to go with the flow as much as I could. Focus on one thing at a time, I told myself. Scott is immortal, okay? What's next?
Do we know who the Black Hand is? I asked, suddenly hungry to get my hands on any information Scott might have. What else was I missing? How many more of my beliefs could he send spinning on their heads? And highest priority, could he help mend my memory?
Last we spoke, we both wanted to know. I spent the summer following leads, which wasn't easy given that I'm living on the run, clean out of cash, working solo, and the Black Hand isn't what you'd call careless. But I've narrowed it down to one man.
His eyes swept to mine.
You ready for this? The Black Hand is Hank Miller.
Hank is what?
We were sitting on two tree stumps in a cave about a quarter mile up the coast, tucked around a jutting cliff and far out of view of the road. The cave was semi-dark with a low ceiling, but it offered protection from the wind and, as Scott had insisted, concealed us from any potential spies of the Black Hand. He'd refused to say another word until he was certain we were alone. Scott struck a match on the bottom of his shoe and lit a fire in a pit of rocks. Light glinted off the jagged walls, and I got my first good look around. There was a backpack and a sleeping bag against the back wall. A cracked mirror was propped against a rock that jutted out like a shelf, along with a razor, a can of shaving cream, and a stick of deodorant. Closer to the mouth of the cave was a large toolbox. On it rested a few dishes, silverware, and a frying pan. Beside it lay a fishing pole and an animal trap. The cave both impressed and saddened me. Scott was anything but helpless, clearly able to survive on his own knowledge and fortitude. But what kind of life did he have, hiding and running from one place to the next?
I've been watching Hank for months, Scott said. This isn't a stab in the dark.
Are you sure Hank is the Black Hand? No offense, but he doesn't fit my picture of an underground militarist or...
an immortal man. The thought seemed unreal. No, absurd.
He runs the most successful car dealership in town, he's a member of the yacht club, and he single-handedly supports the booster club. Why would he care what's going on in the world of Nephilim? He already has everything he could possibly want.
Because he's Nephilim, too, Scott explained, and he doesn't have everything he wants. During the Jewish month of Cheshvan, all Nephilim who've sworn an oath of fealty have to give up their body for 2 weeks. They don't have a choice. They give it up and someone else possesses it, a fallen angel. Rickson was the fallen angel who used to possess the Black Hand, and that's how I came to hear he's burning in hell. The Black Hand might be free, but he hasn't forgotten and he's not about to forgive. That's what the army is for. He's going to try to overthrow the fallen angels.
Back up. Who are the fallen angels?
A gang? That's what it sounded like. I was increasingly doubtful. Hank Miller was the last person in Coldwater who'd lower himself to associate with gangs.
And what do you mean, possesses?
Scott's mouth twitched with a disparaging smile, but to his credit, he answered with patience.
Definition of a fallen angel. Heaven's rejects, and a Nephil's worst nightmare. They force us to swear fealty and then possess our bodies during Cheshvan. They're parasites. They can't feel anything in their own bodies, so they invade ours.
Yeah, Gray, he said at the look of abhorrence I was sure was frozen on my face.
I mean, they literally come inside us and use our bodies like their own. A Nephil is mentally there while they do it, but doesn't have any control.
I tried to swallow Scott's explanation. More than once, I imagined the theme song of the Twilight Zone playing in the background. But the truth of the matter was, I knew he wasn't lying. It was all coming back. The memories were splintered and damaged, but they were there. I'd learned this all before. When or how, I didn't know, but I knew this, all of it, I said. The other night I saw three guys beating up in the field. That's what they were doing? Trying to force him to give up his body for 2 weeks? That's inhumane. It's repulsive. Scott had dropped his eyes, stirring the fire with a stick. My mistake hit me too late. Shame swept through me, and I whispered, Oh, Scott, I wasn't thinking. I'm so sorry you have to go through that. I can't imagine how hard it must be to give up your body.
I haven't sworn fealty, and I'm not going to.
He tossed the stick on the fire, and gold sparks showered into the dark, smoky air of the cave.
If nothing else, that's what the Black Hand taught me. Fallen angels can try any mind trick on me they want. They can chop my head off, cut out my tongue, and burn me to ash. But I'll never swear that oath. I can handle pain, but I can't handle the consequences of that oath.
Mind trick? The skin at the back of my neck tingled, and my thoughts turned once more to Gabe.
A perk of being a fallen angel, he said bitterly. You get to mess with people's minds. Make them see things that aren't real. Nephilim inherited the trick from fallen angels.
It seemed I'd been right about Gabe after all, but he hadn't used a magician's sleight of hand to create the illusion of turning himself into a bear, as Jev had let me believe. He'd used a Nephilim weapon, mind control. Show me how it's done. I want to know exactly how it works.
I'm out of practice, was all he said, rocking back on his stump and lacing his hands behind his head.
Can't you at least try? I said with a playful shot to his knee, hoping to lighten the mood. Show me what we're up against. Come on, surprise me. Make me see something I'm not expecting. Then teach me how it's done. When Scott continued to stare at the fire, the light illuminating the hard edges of his features, the smile slipped from my face. This was anything but a joke to him.
Here's the thing, he said. Those powers are addictive. When you get a taste of them, it's hard to stop. When I ran away 3 months ago and realized what I was capable of, I used my powers every chance I got. If I was hungry, I'd walk into a store, throw what I wanted into a cart, and mind-trick the clerk into bagging my stuff and letting me walk out without paying. It was easy. It made me feel superior. It wasn't until I was spying on the Black Hand one night and saw him do the same thing that I quit cold turkey. I'm not going to live the rest of my life like that. I'm not going to be like him.
He pulled a ring out of his pocket, holding it up in the light. It appeared to be made of iron, and the crown of the ring was stamped with a clenched fist. For one fleeting moment, a strange blue halo of light seemed to radiate from the metal, but it immediately vanished, and I wrote it off as a trick of the light.
All Nephilim have heightened strength, making us physically more powerful than humans. But when I wear this ring, it takes that strength to a whole different level, Scott said solemnly. The Black Hand gave me the ring after he tried to recruit me to his army. I don't know what kind of curse or enchantment is on the ring, or if it's even one of those, but there's something. Anyone with one of these rings is almost physically unstoppable. Before you disappeared in June, you stole the ring from me. The pull to get it back was so intense I didn't sleep, eat, or rest until I found it. I was like a junkie searching for the one thing that could give me my next high. I broke into your house one night after you were kidnapped. I found it in your bedroom in your violin case.
Cello, came my murmured correction. Faint recollection stirred inside me, a sensation of having seen the ring before.
I'm not the smartest guy, but I know this ring isn't harmless. The Black Hand did something to it. He wanted a way to give every member of his army an advantage. Even when I'm not wearing the ring and just relying on my natural strength and powers, the pull for more of both is strong. The only way to beat it is to lay off using my powers and abilities as much as I can.
I tried to sympathize with Scott, but I was a little disappointed. I needed to gain a better understanding of how Gabe had tricked me in case I found myself face to face with him again. And if Hank really was the Black Hand, the leader of an underground and non-human militia, I had to wonder if he was in my life for reasons darker than met the eye. After all, if he was so busy battling fallen angels, how did he have time to run his dealership, be a father, and date my mom? Maybe I was suspicious, but given everything Scott had just told me, I was pretty sure it was warranted. I needed someone on my side who could go up against Hank if it came to that. Right now, the only person I knew of was Scott. I wanted him to keep his integrity, but at the same time, he was the only person I knew of who stood a chance against Hank.
Maybe you could try using the ring's powers for good, I suggested softly after a minute.
Scott scrubbed a hand through his hair, obviously ready to drop the subject. Too late. I've made my decision. I won't wear the ring. It connects me to him.
Don't you ever worry that if you don't wear the ring, it will give Hank a dangerous advantage?
His eyes caught mine, but he avoided answering.
You hungry? I can catch us some bass. It tastes decent pan-seared over the fire.
Without waiting for my response, he grabbed the fishing pole and descended the rocks leading down from the cave. I followed after him, suddenly wishing I could swap my boots for tennis shoes. Scott navigated the rocks in strides and jumps, whereas I was forced to take one cautious step after another.
Fine, I'll put all talk of your powers on hold, I called after him. But I'm not finished. There are still way too many gaps. Let's go back to the night I disappeared. Do you have any guesses as to who kidnapped me?
Scott took a seat on a rock, threading his line with bait. By the time I caught up to him, he was almost finished.
At first I thought it had to be Rickson, he said. That was before I learned he's in hell. I wanted to come back and look for you, but it wasn't that simple. The Black Hand has spies everywhere, and given what happened in the funhouse, I figured I'd have the cops on my tail, too. But I didn't.
He looked sideways at me.
Don't you find it a little strange? The cops had to have known I was in the funhouse that night with you and Rickson. You would have told them. You probably told them I was shot, too. So why didn't they ever come looking for me? Why'd they let me off the hook? It's almost like...
He caught himself.
Like what?
Like someone came in after and cleaned up. And I'm not talking about physical evidence. I'm talking about mind tricks. Erasing memories. Someone powerful enough to make the police look the other way.
A Nephil, you mean?
A shrug. It makes sense, doesn't it? Maybe the Black Hand didn't want the police looking for me. Maybe he wanted to find me himself and take care of me off the record. If he finds me, trust me, he's not handing me over to the police for questioning. He'll lock me in one of his prisons and make me regret the day I ran out on him.
So we were looking for someone strong enough to tamper with minds, or as Scott put it, erase memories. The correlation to my own lost memory didn't slip past me. Could a Nephil have done this to me? A knot tightened in my stomach as I pondered the possibility.
How many Nephilim have that kind of power? I asked.
Who knows? Definitely the Black Hand.
Have you ever heard of a Nephil named Jev, or a fallen angel for that matter?
I added, increasingly aware that Jev was most likely one or the other. Not that the realization made me feel the least bit consoled.
No, but that's not saying much. Almost as soon as I found out about Nephilim, I had to go into hiding. Why?
The other night I met a guy named Jev. He knew about Nephilim. He stopped the three guys. I caught myself. No need to be vague, even though it was easier on my state of mind. He stopped the fallen angels I told you about from forcing a Nephil named BJ into swearing fealty. This is going to sound crazy, but Jev gave off some kind of energy. I felt it like electricity. It was a lot stronger than anything the others gave off.
Probably a good indicator of his power, Scott said. Taking on three fallen angels speaks for itself.
He's that powerful, and you've never heard of him?
Believe it or not, I know about as much as you when it comes to this stuff.
I remembered Jev's words to me. I tried to kill you. What did that mean? Was he mixed up with my kidnapping after all? And was he strong enough to erase my memory? Based on the intensity of the power radiating from him, he was capable of more than a few simple mind tricks. A lot more.
Knowing what I do about the Black Hand, I'm surprised I'm still a free man, Scott said. He must hate that I've made a fool of him.
About that, why did you desert Hank's army?
Scott sighed, dropping his hands heavily on his knees.
This is a conversation I didn't want to have. There's no easy way to say this, so I'm just going to put it out there. The night your dad died, I was supposed to keep an eye on him. He was on his way to a dangerous meeting, and the Black Hand wanted to make sure he was safe. The Black Hand said if I succeeded, it proved he could count on me. He wanted me in his army, but it wasn't what I wanted.
A chill of premonition tingled up my spine. The last thing I'd expected was for Scott to bring my dad into this.
My dad knew Hank Miller?
I blew off the Black Hand's order. Figured I'd give him the finger and make my point. But all I really succeeded in doing was letting an innocent man die.
I blinked, Scott's words cascading over me like a bucket of ice water.
You let my dad die? You let him walk into danger and did nothing to help him.
Scott spread his hands.
I didn't know it was going to be like that. I thought the Black Hand was crazy. I had him pegged as an egotistical freak. I never got the whole Nephilim thing, not until it was too late.
I set my eyes straight ahead, staring steadfastly at the ocean. An unwanted sensation clenched my chest, squeezing relentlessly. My dad. All this time, Scott had known the truth. He hadn't given it to me until I'd dragged it out of him.
Rickson pulled the trigger, Scott said, his voice breaking quietly into my thoughts. I let your dad walk into a trap, but it was Rickson who stood at the end of it.
Rickson, I repeated. In bitter pieces, it was all coming back. One awful glimpse at a time. Rickson leading me into the funhouse. Rickson admitting matter-of-factly that he'd killed my dad. Rickson leveling his gun at me. I couldn't remember enough to paint the full picture, but the flashes were enough. I was sick to my stomach. If Rickson didn't kidnap me, who did? I asked.
Remember how I said I spent the summer following the Black Hand? At the beginning of August, he made a trip out to White Mountain National Forest. He drove to a remote cabin and stayed less than 20 minutes. A long drive for such a short visit, right? I didn't dare get close enough to look in the windows, but I overheard a conversation he had on his phone a couple days later, back in Coldwater. He told the person on the other line that the girl was still at the cabin, and he needed to know she was a clean slate. Those were his words. He said there was no room for error. I'm starting to wonder if the girl he was referring to...
was me. I finished for him, stunned. Hank Miller, an immortal. Hank Miller, the Black Hand. Hank, possibly my kidnapper.
There's one dude who could probably get answers, Scott said, tugging his eyebrow. If anyone knows how to get information, it's him. Tracking him down could get tricky. I wouldn't know where to start. And given the circumstances, he might not jump to help us, especially since the last time I saw him, he nearly broke my jaw for trying to kiss you.
I flinched. Kiss me? What? Who is this guy?
Scott frowned. That's right. I guess you wouldn't remember him, either. Your ex. Patch.
Chapter 15.
Back up, I ordered. Patch was my ex? This didn't match with Marcy's story, or V's for that matter. The two of you broke up. Something to do with Marcy, I think.
He flipped his palms up.
That's all I know. I moved back to town in the middle of the drama.
Are you sure he was my boyfriend?
Your words, not mine.
What did he look like?
Scary.
Where is he now? I asked more forcefully.
Like I said, finding him won't be easy.
Do you know anything about a necklace he might have given me?
You ask a lot of questions.
Marcy said Patch was her boyfriend. She said he gave me a necklace that belongs to her, and now she wants it back. She said he made me see the good in her and brought us together.
Scott stroked his chin. His eyes laughed at me. And you bought it?
My mind reeled. Patch was my boyfriend? Why had Marcy lied? To get the necklace? What could she possibly want with it? If Patch was my boyfriend, it explained the flashes of déjà vu every time I heard his name. But if he was my boyfriend and I'd meant something to him, where was he now? Anything else you can give me on Patch?
I hardly knew the guy, and what I knew scared the crap out of me. I'll see if I can hunt him down, but I can't make any promises. In the meantime, let's focus on a sure thing. If we can get enough dirt on Hank, maybe we can figure out why he's taken an interest in you and your mom, and what he's planning next, and come up with a way to bring him down. We've both got something to gain from this. You in, Gray?
Oh, I'm in, I said fiercely. I stayed with Scott until the sun dipped into the horizon. I left my half-eaten fish dinner behind and hiked back along the shoreline. Scott and I said our goodbyes at the guardrail. He didn't want to make a habit of showing his face in public, and judging by what he'd told me about Hank and his Nephilim spies, I understood his caution. I promised to visit again soon, but he shot down the idea. Routine traffic toward the cave was too risky, he claimed. Instead, he'd find me. On the drive home, I reflected. I walked myself through everything Scott had told me. A strange feeling simmered inside me. Revenge, maybe. Or hatred in its purest form. I didn't have enough evidence to say for sure that Hank was behind my kidnapping.